Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We are fortunate to have in our studios here at Clean Cuts Music and Sound in Hamden, James Carroll. His latest book is Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World. And, of course, James Carroll is a noted writer in our society and writes for the Boston Globe and Column, but his book that set him into the national spotlight, I think, is Constantine's Sword, and also an acclaimed documentary. He's here today to talk with us about Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And Jim Carroll, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
This book took a bunch of reading, but it was absolutely worth the reading. And I think that one of the things that you, maybe starting off in the broad sense, is the idea about the overarching idea that Jerusalem is something that captures the Western imagination, Muslim, Christian, Jew. Three continents, four continents now, actually.
Yeah.
How it captures the imagination. It's the soul of so much of what national aspirations are built on and spiritual aspirations are built on.
You know, when you see the earliest maps, it's interesting that cartographers put Jerusalem in the dead center of the world.
Mm.
So you have the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe intersecting in Jerusalem. And, of course, in an odd way, they sort of do. And Jerusalem turns out to be the intersection of the human imagination. Certainly in Western culture, that's true. And you see it in everything from the Bible to our own American political rhetoric that defines this nation as a city on a hill. So from 3,000 years ago, maybe more, right to the next political speech we hear, Jerusalem is an inch below the surface of everything.
And this is a city, when you go back, let me go back. Before we go back to the beginning of the city, there was a wonderful piece that you wrote in the introduction in your book about your own sojourn as a young priest.
Yes.
To Jerusalem.
Yes.
When you were wrestling with your own priest, being a priest.
Right.
And what happened to you on that trip?
Yeah.
And going to the churches and the rest.
Well, I was a Catholic priest from 1969 to 1974, a lifetime ago, I admit. But you'll remember, maybe you won't, but some of your listeners will remember what a tumultuous time that was.
I remember well.
Good. And I took the tumult into myself the way many people of my generation did. And for me, it was a religious crisis. I was defined in my priesthood by the war in Vietnam, by a collapse of faith in the American consensus, and also by the revolution in religious awareness that came in the 1960s for us Christians, and in particular us Catholics, not least of which was reckoning with the unfinished business of the Holocaust and the way in which the Christian world, and the Catholic Church included, failed miserably in its relationship to what
you spend so much time in your life working on writing.
Yes,
about
it's true. It's a conundrum for me. Yeah. I'm a Catholic. I believe in the Church. I love the memory of Jesus, and it's a big trouble for me that that my Church failed the great moral test of the 20th century, and we've been reckoning with it ever since. To its credit, and the Second Vatican Council, which took place in the middle of the 1960s, was key to that. That's the council that renounced the Christ killer myth against the Jewish people and affirmed the permanence of God's covenant with the people of Israel. So, you know, it all added up to a lot of change. And my faith was at risk, I would say. And I took the crisis to Jerusalem, which is curious, actually, when I look back on it. I was an Irish guy. I could have gone to Dublin. I fancied myself a poet. I could have gone to the west coast of Ireland. I looked for a next job as a priest at a Native American reservation in New Mexico. I interviewed for a job in Ghana, in Africa. I was here and there and everywhere. And I found myself in Jerusalem in the summer of 1973.
Hmm.
On the eve of the Yom Kippur War.
Right.
And you won't be surprised when I say the brackets within which I was having my struggle were on one side religion, the other side violence. The Vietnam War, violence. Anyway, the short of it is that I'm not sure what I expected in Jerusalem, but what I found was a mess. And that was a shock to me because I was a mess and I was looking for a way out of the mess.
Right.
And I went to the holiest place in the Christian world, the Holy Sepulchre, the place that memorializes the death and resurrection of Jesus. And what I found was contending, you could almost say warring, Christian monks, Franciscan friars against Greek Orthodox monks, against Ethiopian Coptics, against Armenians, all claiming different pieces of turf in this ancient basilica, sometimes even coming to blows over it. The place is crumbling because they can't agree on the maintenance of it. I went into the holiest place in Christendom, the little cave, that cave-like space that memorializes the tomb from which Jesus was raised. And there's a toothless monk in there waiting for me with a candle, and he puts the candle in my face, says, $1. And I fled the place. And I found myself in the so-called garden tomb outside the walls of the old city, which is a tomb of Jesus that was discovered by English-speaking Protestants in the 19th century. They, too, were scandalized by the chaos of the Holy Sepulchre. And what they found was a beautiful place, a garden, beautiful trees that cast shade, grass, benches, and sure enough, an ancient tomb that archaeologists say probably dated to around the time of Jesus. And they said, aha, this is lovely. This is beautiful. This is orderly. This must be where Jesus was raised from the dead. And that began the tradition of honoring the garden tomb. And you can go there to this day. It's mm-hmm. a stone's throw from the Damascus Gate. I went there and I thought, no, this is not real. Actually, I recognized something, which was if I, as a believing person of the biblical tradition, think that God touches the earth in some way, and I do, what I recognized was it isn't in this beautiful, neat, orderly, tidy garden. No, God touches the earth in the mess of the lives we lead. And I went back to the chaotic and contentious Holy Sepulchre, and I felt, actually, this is who I am. And I experienced in that way the nearness of God, which is an ancient experience people have had in Jerusalem for thousands of years in a whole range of ways. And I had my version of it. And it enabled me to reclaim my faith. I'm a committed Catholic to this day. It also gave me the space I needed in my conscience and in my inner life to ultimately leave the Catholic priesthood, which I did a year later, and to make my life as a writer, which I've been doing ever since. It's about claiming the freedom of one's inner life, and that happened to me in Jerusalem.
You touched on something when you began to speak about this, and early in the book you write about God's ambivalence, and it talks about violence is the problem the Bible is addressing. And you spend a great deal of time talking about the notion of violence in the Bible, but in a very different way.
Yeah.
Because part of the things, and maybe I'm completely misinterpreting your work.
Yeah, go ahead.
But that you're positing on some level that the Bible, even though it's a war document in many ways,
yep.
is a document that also speaks against violence.
Right.
It's a document that is actually a document of peace and nonviolence more than it is a document promoting violence.
The Bible is a record of the human attempt to mitigate and resist violence. That's my argument.
Right.
Some people are scandalized that there's so much violence in the Bible. There are 1,000 passages that speak of God's violence. The most violent book in the Bible is the Christian book of Revelation at the end. These texts are violent. They have to be because violence is their subject. Violence is the problem of the human condition. It's our main problem. And all of us, in all that we do, our loving, our creation of art, our work, our mundane activities, our spiritual activities, in everything we do, we're at bottom, we're looking for a way to overcome the violence of the human condition. And the Bible is a record of a set of ingenious moves that human beings have made in relationship to one they call God, and have come out of violence again and again, finding ways to surpass it or even transcend it. Let me quickly give you an example. The most famous incident of the Hebrew scriptures, I would argue, is the so-called Babylonian captivity. When the Hebrews...
It's part of the heart of your book.
It really is. The Hebrews living in Jerusalem are captured by an overlord empire, the most powerful empire of the time, well, certainly in that region, the Babylonians. And the Babylonians destroy the city, destroy the temple, and kidnap the Jews away to Babylon. This was an act of ancient ethnic cleansing, and the point of doing it was to destroy this people's identity. That was what this war was supposed to do, and that didn't happen. This is what I'm talking about. Look what happened. In Babylon, these people looked back at Jerusalem and realized that they had become different. They weren't like other people. And in Babylon, they couldn't behave as they were expected to behave. They were supposed to just begin worshiping the local gods, adopting the local customs, assuming the local identity. But they couldn't. By the rivers of Babylon, we looked back at you, O Zion, and wept. But in the weeping, they uncovered something new about themselves. And the key to it was they recognized for the first time exactly who their God was. Their God wasn't just another tribal deity. It wasn't just the God of Jerusalem or the God of the Hebrews. This was the God of the cosmos. This was the one God. This is the beginning of what we call monotheism. And here's the point. Monotheism, the oneness of God, is a principle of peace, because the assertion is that this God has created everybody, not just our tribe, which was the more typical affirmation. This God has created all human beings. Therefore, all human beings are meant to live together in peace, including the Babylonians. Including the Babylonians. There's the point. These people understood something new about who God was, and it was a call to reconciliation. They went back to Jerusalem.
They were allowed. The Babylonians allowed them to go
back. The Babylonians were defeated by a rival empire who allowed the Hebrews to leave after some decades in the so-called captivity. They returned to Jerusalem, rebuilt their temple, but now it was different because where before they had had in their Holy of Holies an object, the Ark of the Temple, the Ark of the Covenant, so-called, that had disappeared in the chaos. And now they created the Holy of Holies, and it was vacant, which is another principle of peace. Because what they were saying was, our God can't be represented. Our God can't be named. We don't own our God. Therefore, our God can't be at the head of an army marching into war. This God is different. This God has a kind of ethical requirement on us that sets us on a different track. And that's the beginning of what we call the religion of Judaism. It began in violence, but it began in a way of mitigating and overcoming violence. Now, violence continues to have its grip on all of us.
Right.
And it continued to have its grip on the Jewish people. But they had begun a journey out of violence that the prophets continue, the tradition of self-criticism, of constantly understanding that we've failed in the call to rise above this and to be defined utterly by, as the Great Commandment puts it, how we treat the neighbor.
Now, I really want to jump in to kind of slide this into how it fits into this whole thesis, a beautiful thesis you have about Jerusalem. But let me just, I mean, is the question, because you write about Babylon. We talk about the destruction of the temple by the Romans in Jerusalem.
Yes.
In around 70 AD, about the huge war taking place in around 90 AD when the Apocalypse, the Revelations were written. We're in the midst of a horrible battle where 1 million Jews were killed again in another war.
It's true.
Back then.
It's true.
And that – so the question is it a question of battling the struggle being for you – I think I know what it is, but just a question. The struggle being a battle within the Bible – for the idea and way of life of nonviolence to become the way, or is it a battle that is more of a dialectic battle that's a constant between our inside of us as a species and as human cultures, always a battle between living a nonviolent way, but violence is always in our midst and you can't get away from it.
Well, I'm not utopian. I don't believe that violence is going to go away. And as long as there's violence as part of the human condition, we have to find realistic ways to resist it and to match it and to control it, which I think in the experience of human beings means that there has to be structures of justice and structures of law that are modes of controlling, resisting, deflecting, punishing violence. But I do believe that we make progress. The law itself is progress. It used to be that feuds among and between human beings were resolved simply by who had the most power. That's not the case now. Certainly within states, within societies, feuds, complaints, offenses, crimes are adjudicated not by who has the most power, but by a procedure of law in which human beings come to some conclusion about who's right. And that's a huge leap forward. It's a leap forward that begins in that ancient world. Hammurabi, the Babylonians, in fact, and the Law of Moses, and around the world in other civilizations, people coming to this great breakthrough of law, a measure of controlling violence. We're in a threshold period, I believe, living now in the 21st century, where law organizing the way of resolving disputes within states, we're on the threshold of establishing law as a way of organizing disputes between and among states, international law, as opposed to the need to go to war. So, and we see the first steps in that direction. The International Criminal Court is a very obvious example. What am I talking about? I see a pattern coming out of the biblical experience that is fundamental to our civilization, that is at home in Jerusalem, which is one of the reasons the myth of Jerusalem then becomes locating for us. You mentioned the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 and 135. It's in the thick of that violence that Christianity is born. And Christian texts are also wartime literature and also right. an attempt to mitigate violence, which is one of the reasons we Christians, in effect, are judged by the memory of the nonviolence of Jesus. So even though we Christians have embarked on violence again and again, often in the name of God, often calling upon our own sacred texts, the book of Revelation is by far the most violent book in the Bible. But that's because it's an almost literal description, as if by a reporter, of the destruction of Jerusalem that was accomplished by the Romans. The author of the book of Revelation.
Between 70 and 135 you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, that's right.
Period, right.
So the author of the book of Revelation, which is written around 90, is basically making sense of this horrible chaos and destruction. And he's asking the question, well, what could this possibly mean? And his answer is, this is the way the world will end, but out of this destruction, God will somehow heal the world and bring us to the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem. It's a beautiful idea. It's an idea that had deadly consequences, alas, when Christians turned it into the basic theme that the mode to salvation is through destruction. And once that got set in the Christian imagination, there were terrible things in its train. The most obvious example I could think of would be the Crusades. The Crusades were an act of savage destruction undertaken in the name of salvation, as if this is what God willed. In fact, as you recall, the slogan of the First Crusade was, God wills it. Well, that's appalling to us now, looking back on it. What it shows us is, even as we attempt to mitigate violence, to resist it, we human beings are constantly getting drawn back into it.
And Jerusalem was at the heart of that.
Well, Jerusalem is a city that, even as it surpasses itself, is also forever the cockpit of violence. No surprise that it should be a contended city today between Israelis and Palestinians.
I mean, you one of the things when you talk about that the period, the destruction of the temple, kind of defining Christian response to Jesus, the dovetailing of that destruction of the temple in 70 AD with the rise of Christianity a couple hundred years later with Constantine, and how that changed not just everything, but changed the nature of Jesus and Christianity when the empire that killed Jesus became the same one that took his name.
It's true. Well, Constantine is a turning point here because Constantine is the welding of state power to religious doctrine. It wasn't so much that Constantine became a Christian, it's that the empire became the church.
His mother did. He had no choice.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, speaking of his mother, it takes us back to the theme of Jerusalem, because his mother made a famous pilgrimage, just as Constantine is identifying as a Christian, and as he's attempting to unify this vast empire that he's just succeeded in taking over, taking complete control of. And his big problem is, how do you unify an empire that goes from the far stretches of northwest Europe, as far as the British Isles, all the way to North Africa, into the Middle East? What do the human beings who live in this vast stretch possibly have in common? And he came up with an answer, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. And the symbol of the Lord Jesus Christ par excellence was the true cross that his mother discovered in Jerusalem in the very year that 325 or 326, that Constantine was defining his empire as Christian. That was the time of the Nicene Council that gave us the Nicene Creed, which is the first clear definition of what Christian belief is. So Jerusalem gets valorized. Now, what is Constantine lifting up? Not Rome. Not even Constantinople, but Jerusalem. And Jerusalem becomes a kind of north star of the Christian imagination at that point. And let me just point out one thing about it, which is by now, in the fourth century, until now, Jews and Christians were more or less equal minorities in the Roman Empire. They were rivals. They were also intermingled with each other. Some Jews revered Jesus, and some Jesus people continued to observe expressly Jewish practices. So it wasn't clear that these were two different entities, not fully clear anyway. With Constantine's conversion, that changed. And the claims that the church made against the synagogue became made with state power. And for reasons of that imperial unity, the empire needed a radical break between the church and the synagogue. More than that, it needed the disempowering, the discrediting of Jewish religion, the final triumph of Christian religion. And the great emblem of that was the disappearance of the Jewish people from Jerusalem. How do we know that the claims we make for Jesus are true? Well, look, the temple is destroyed and the Jews are gone from Jerusalem. And before you knew it, that became a tenet of theology, and Jews were forbidden to be in Jerusalem. And the ruined temple became a permanent Christian symbol of Christian victory. So Christians controlling Jerusalem into the 5th, 6th, 7th century shamefully used the remnant of the temple, the so-called Temple Mount, the ruins that the Romans left, they used it as the city garbage dump. What was that? It was a way of proving Christian claims. So, and this is key, Mark, because in the Christian imagination, the absence of Jews from Jerusalem became a theological point of doctrine. What is that saying? It's saying that Christians are going to have a visceral reaction against any Jewish return, which is part of what happens in the 20th century with the rise of Zionism, the return of the Jewish people to the Jewish homeland, powerfully achieved by the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. And one whole element of Christianity is viscerally opposed to that without fully even understanding why. And to this day, there is a kind of visceral skepticism about Jewish sovereignty in Israel. And one of the elements of that skepticism is this long denigrating of Jews and Judaism by keeping them away from Jerusalem. Meanwhile, what did Jews do? Jews did a version of what they had done in Babylon. They didn't forget Jerusalem.
Every year, prayers.
Yeah, and you can say it. Next year in Jerusalem.
Next year in Jerusalem.
And through the centuries, Jews prayed for the weather in Jerusalem. Jews never. In fact, the imagined Jerusalem of Jewish memory, I say this as a non-Jew from outside the tradition, strikes me, was an element of the cohesion that enabled the Jews to survive as a people. What's the single largest, most what the single most amazing thing about the Jewish people. It's their survival as a people across these thousands of years. And since the first century, second century, third century, the Jerusalem as the kind of fixed point in the Jewish imagination has been key to that. And that's, of course, what makes the Jewish return to Jerusalem in 1948 different from the and some people often don't really grasp this, different from other forms of white European colonialism when native peoples are exploited, displaced, even murdered. So the conflict that comes around the achievement of the State of Israel, which is a catastrophe for the people of Palestine, has this tragic aspect to it. But it is not colonialism. It is the return of the Jewish people to the Jewish homeland. And that's a key element.
We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to pick up. We're going to talk about the other monotheistic religion and why it has such a hold on Jerusalem as well, what that means. We'll talk about the obsession in America with Jerusalem, about a man in history. His name is Muhammad Ali, who is not necessarily the one you're thinking of, who was key figure in what the future Jerusalem became, and more as we talk with James Carroll. Jim Carroll's latest book, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World, of course, author of Constantine the Sword. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. James Carroll is in our studio. His latest book is Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World. Many of us know him from his book, Constantine's Sword. He is also a Boston Globe columnist, and as well as he is this distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and a fellow at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and joins us here in our studios in Baltimore. Jim, one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking at the end was that before we went to break, the Jews always looked to Palestine as a place to go back to home. It was part of the soul and spirit of what it meant to be a Jew. For Christians, it was the place where Jesus died and rose again.
Yes.
So it's center to these two great monotheistic faiths. Also, Islam.
Yes.
People always kind of say Islam. They don't really have anything to do with Jerusalem. They have nothing to do with Jerusalem.
Yeah,
they just wanted to take it.
It's one of the great unappreciated facts of the story. Having said what I just said a few minutes ago about the unbreakable tie to Jerusalem of Jews, and having also haven't quite said it, but the Christian imagination fixed upon Jerusalem, certainly since Constantine, but always thinking of the story of Jesus as a journey to Jerusalem, where his story comes to climax. It's crucially important to understand that for Islam, Jerusalem is key as well. And we can't actually think of these three traditions and their connection to Jerusalem as mutually exclusive. We have to understand that Jews, Muslims, and Christians are all alike if they are different in the ways they do it. They are all alike in being existentially tied to this one city. The story is easily told. Muhammad has his version of the insight I was describing before that the Jews had in Babylon. Muhammad comes to a sense of the oneness of God. We're not exactly clear how. He's under the influence, no doubt, of Jews and Christians in Arabia. But he comes to a powerful sense, vivid sense, of the oneness of God, one with him, one with all people, one with the cosmos. He insists against the religious traditions of the tribal cultures he's living among. He insists on the immateriality of God. This God cannot be represented. His version of what the Jews came to when they kept the Holy of Holies vacant. The immateriality of God had this profound effect for the humblest person, which is that this God is available to me. I can have a relationship with this God. This was a profound breakthrough in the religious imagination of Arabs. And this is what accounts for the astonishing sweep of the religion of Islam among the Arab people first, and then across North Africa into Iberia, in the other direction toward Asia, through Asia into what's present-day Pakistan. It was this vivid experience of the oneness of God that of which Muhammad was such an eloquent and powerful prophet. And the first thing they did with this experience was turn toward Jerusalem. So within 5 years of the death of the prophet, Muslim armies approached Jerusalem. They were going there because they knew that this was the home of the one God. They were going there to honor the remnant of the Jewish temple, which was there, which was, as they believed, the place where the one God had first manifested himself, the place where Abraham had embodied the insight to monotheism, as the Bible tells the story. So Muslims approached Jerusalem. It's an interesting story because, you know, they did not take the city violently. They surrounded the city. They sent in word that they would like to come in. Yes, they were a conquering army. That was the nature of the game in those days. But they did not want to kill anybody. And the Orthodox patriarch, the Byzantine patriarch who was the ruler of Jerusalem, opened the gates. The Muslim armies came in, and they took the city nonviolently. And from then on, that late 7th century moment on, Muslims controlled Jerusalem until 1917, with the exception of 6 or 7 or 8 decades of the 12th century, right, during the Crusades. But with the exception of that less than a century, Muslims controlled the city. That's what made the difference between Islamic Jerusalem and Christian and Jewish Jerusalem, because what Christian and Jewish Jerusalem had in common was they had both lost the city. And so Jews and Christians in different ways had the remembered and the imagined city at the center of their faith. Muslims didn't have to remember or imagine Jerusalem. They had it. But they had it as a key center of their religious imagination, which you can see to this day wonderfully enshrined in the Noble Sanctuary, as they call it, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, two of the most magnificent structures on the planet. I would say the Dome of the Rock is the most magnificent religious structure anywhere. And those structures embody the Islamic imagination and its tie to this one place. So today, that defines, of course, the absolute justice of the Palestinian Muslim claim to Jerusalem. And that defines, you know, one half of the argument between Israelis and Palestinians today. And it is an argument that has to be respected.
It absolutely does. And one of the things that struck me as I was reading your book, it hit me. I wrote this little piece after I was reading in the center of your book about Islam and Jerusalem, was that unlike the Christians, and in some ways unlike the Jews as well, but not in the same specificity as with Christians, the Muslims did not look at Jerusalem in exclusivity to others.
It's true.
I mean, they brought the Jews back in.
It's true. And the Christians.
Christians to stay.
Christians and Jews lived more or less unmolested minorities in Jerusalem across the centuries. There were occasional periods when local tyrants took control,
right.
Mistreated everybody, including Christians and Jews. But by and large, it's an amazing story of mutuality and respect.
There's a lot of that in Islamic history, period.
That's true. It's true. And
India,
and we don't We in the West remember it differently because we were traumatized by the loss of Jerusalem during the Crusades. We were traumatized by our being threatened by Islam just as Europe began to gel. And this is an important part of the story. Europe defined itself positively over against the negative of Islam. And that's, of course, defining through the almost three centuries of the Crusades. And what were those three centuries? Those were the centuries when European, as we called it, Christendom, Western civilization, kind of gelled when the culture that you and I are part of came into its own. And what was a key element of that coming into its own?
Jerusalem.
The enemy outside.
Oh, right, right. I mean, right
the
right.
enemy outside
right.
who owned Jerusalem. And that's the insult. How dare they own Jerusalem? How dare they own the place where Jesus, our Lord, died and was raised from the dead? How dare the infidel have this place? It's a sacrilege. European Christians experienced it as a sacrilege. That all went below the surface in modernity, but only an inch below the surface, Mark, because that's what we're dealing with today.
Right, right.
And,
right.
You know, last week there were hearings in the U.S. Senate. 3 weeks before that, there were hearings in the U.S. Congress about Islam America. And what's going on here? An inch below the surface of Western culture, including America, is a deep, old, inbred hostility toward Islam. And we have to surface it. We have to reckon with it. We have to acknowledge it.
The interesting thing here, there's many interesting things here, is trying to lead this into connecting this with the West and America, the fourth continent affected by Jerusalem.
Indeed.
The Indeed. One we Indeed. Grew up on and live on.
Indeed.
Is that there's a juxtaposition here in the book. There are two different subparts. One has to do with how the Holy Land, how Jerusalem was part of the founding soul of the United States of America.
Indeed.
Well, let's start with that.
Well, start with it.
Then it'll take us to Muhammad Ali.
Well, it goes right to the beginning, because one of the things that we don't know about Christopher Columbus is that when Christopher Columbus sailed west from Spain, he was headed, yes, for the Indies, whatever that was, yes, for riches, gold and silver, however he could acquire it. But he was headed for Jerusalem, Mark. We know from his journals, and in the secular enlightened age, this was something that made biographers of Columbus uncomfortable. You don't see much of it referred to in the great Admiral Morrison biography. But Columbus had a profound religious European Christian agenda. Muslims were blocking the way to Jerusalem to the east. By going to the west, Columbus was looking for a new route to Jerusalem so that Europeans could take it. That was a defining element for Christopher Columbus of what his adventure was all about. And it sets a spark. That spark gets blown into embers a little more than a century later when the dissenters from Great Britain, what we call the Pilgrims or the Puritans, sailed west and came to the New World. And you'll remember the story in 1630 that John Winthrop, the leader of a group of Puritans who were just approaching the New World, and as they came into the harbor, he gave a sermon, which is famous in American lore as the City on a Hill sermon. We are going to establish a city on a hill. We're going to make it work this time. What was it? It was Jerusalem.
The city on the hill.
Yes, and we were going to make the new Jerusalem. This was bringing about the end time, Mark. This was bringing about the fulfillment of history. This was the salvation of mankind. This wasn't just turf. This wasn't just getting a place to grow corn and move west. There was a transcendent purpose here. This was to be the Messiah nation, the Redeemer nation. We were redeeming history. And what was it? In Boston, I'm from Boston. We like to think the City on a Hill speech was given in Boston
but
Harbor.
Not Salem.
It wasn't Boston Harbor. They got off the boat and started their village, and they named it Salem.
Which is another name for?
Another name for Jerusalem.
Right.
And that was the beginning of a tradition that carried forward for three centuries.
little piece of your book here that's really interesting is that Jerusalem, Salem, Zion are the most common place names of communities and cities, towns in America of any other.
That's true. If you take those three names, Zion, Salem, and Jerusalem, you get, 150 cities, towns, and villages in this country. That's a signal. We shouldn't make too much of it, perhaps, but it's a signal of the way in which this place was in the imagination, the American imagination. And let me return to that defining idea I referred to before. Destruction is a method of salvation. Moving west, right. We have to destroy the native peoples and the native cultures. How did people do that in good conscience? How did the settlers and the frontiers people and the pioneers, how did they so ruthlessly go after native peoples? They thought they were doing God's will. God required this because the mode to salvation, this is the Messiah nation, is destruction. And that frame of reference came into its own most powerfully in American history at the U.S. Civil War. Mm-hmm. Now, the history of the Civil War is complicated, and I don't want to oversimplify it here. But one of the things we don't pay enough attention to is the religious underpinning of what happened between 1860 and 1865. We know that Abraham Lincoln was not a religious man. We think that by then the separation of church and state was well established. We don't think of the Civil War as religious, and yet it was. The Battle Hymn of the Republic is written right out of the book of Revelation. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. The deaths of 700,000 Americans, think of that number, in less than 5 years, was defining for this country. And out of those deaths, we drew the salvation of the Union. We drew a new sense of what this nation was. And it was a solidifying of the idea of this nation as the Messiah nation. And Lincoln's own story reinforced that. We're talking about unconscious forces here and coincidences. The coincidence that his name was Abraham. This whole history begins right. with Abraham and the call to sacrifice his son, which God stops at the last moment. Well, our Abraham put hundreds of thousands of sons on the altar of the nation, to use a phrase that the historian Harry Stout uses. But more than that, our Abraham, who, by the way, began his public life in a town in Illinois called New Salem, was also, he was the new Moses. He wasn't able to cross the river into the Promised Land. But much more to the point, he was an American Jesus. You remember that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated on Good Friday, an extraordinary coincidence given the religious currents playing below the surface here. And you can imagine the content of every sermon given in every northern pulpit that Easter Sunday, 2 days later, about the sacrifice of our American Christ, who laid down his life for the sake of the Union. It was then that Lincoln began to be referred to as he with a capital H. And it was then that the United States began to be referred to as a singular noun. The United States is instead of the United States are, as Gary Wills and others point out. And that was the very day, Good Friday, 1865, that the Civil War came to an end. The Confederate flag, the last one, came down over Memphis that morning. And that night, Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln went to the theater, as is well known. What's not so well known, Mrs. Lincoln reported this to her minister the next morning. On the way to the theater, they were discussing what they would do now that they could imagine a future without the war after he left the White House. And like many people on the cusp of retirement, they were talking about traveling.
Yeah, wherever they want to go.
And Lincoln's last words, he leaned over to her in his seat in the theater and said, "I think I should like to go to Jerusalem." and then he was shot. Now, we shouldn't make something mystical out of that, but it goes to the point of how below the surface of our entire culture this city and what it generates moves.
Always. And during that period, as you write, perhaps unleashed on some levels by Muhammad Ali, the Egyptian caliph in the Ottoman Empire.
Bringing Egypt into the modern era.
And stopping the Christians from killing each other in Jerusalem.
And that's right. and welcoming European Christians into Jerusalem, which begins in the 19th century. The other great movement, which is called Restorationist Christianity.
Right. This thing you talk about, the America's Palestine
mania. Palestine mania, yes. And beginning in the early 19th century, Americans and then British and other European Christians of an evangelical kind, people for whom reading the Bible was reading literal descriptions of the truth, people who believed that they could walk in the evening with Jesus as their companion. This evangelical Christianity was an important part of what enabled so many men to go to their deaths during the Civil War. The piety of American life in the early to mid 19th century was a big surprise. Thomas Jefferson never foresaw it. Thomas Jefferson was a more or less secular person who thought America would be more or less the way he was.
Right.
In 1790, there were 2,500 Christian congregations in the United States. By 1860, there were 53,000, most of them evangelical, fervent people who believed that the return of Jews to Jerusalem was a necessary precondition for the return of the Messiah. So restorationism began, restoring Jews to Jerusalem. And of course, the point of having Jews in Jerusalem was that they would convert to Christianity. So missionaries began to go to Jerusalem to preach to the Jews the truth of Christian doctrine, not just because they were inveterate proselytizers, but because this was necessary to bring about the end of history, the Messiah nation, you see? And so through the 19th century, we have this Christian movement. If you go to the city of Jerusalem today, you might stay in a fine hotel called the American Colony. It's in East Jerusalem. The American Colony was established by American evangelical Christians in the late 19th century, and it was a colony of proselytizing Christians aiming to convert Jews. There were German evangelical Christians arriving in Jerusalem at the same time. The German colony is a neighborhood in Jerusalem named for them.
Right.
And this was part of an awakening in Europe and America to Jerusalem that was part of Jerusalem coming into modernity. And it's not unrelated, of course, that this is the same period in which Zionism begins to take form, picking up steam, of course, with the assaults against Jews in Russia, Eastern Europe, and Europe. So that by the time Zionism is established as a formal movement, the World Zionist Congress, late in the 19th century, established by Theodore Herzl, who was traumatized by the Dreyfus affair in France.
French Jewish officer in the French army who was put on trial for treason.
Exactly.
It became a huge trial.
A growing sense that Jews are at risk in Europe, which goes hand in hand with a broader Jerusalem mania. Meanwhile, of course, there are people who live in the city. There's always the fantasy city and the real city. And the ancient story is people driven by the fantasy come and arrive with, as I put it, dreams of the end of the world in their minds and weapons in their hands. And the local people are constantly somehow made to suffer by these fervent arrivals. And that happens in the late 19th and early 20th century as well.
Here we are today.
Yes.
Thinking about the history you've written and given to us in this book, yeah. Jerusalem, Jerusalem. It's still the heartbeat of the imagination of all three monotheistic faiths. It's still one of the critical centers and issues facing Palestinians and Israelis on their collective future.
It's true. And there are two points I would make about today. One, the Palestinians and Israelis are in a corner. They're at an impasse. This history suggests that the walls of that corner were made by somebody else, the unacknowledged third party to this conflict. And that's this long history of Western, on the one hand, contempt for Jews, anti-Semitism, a Christian habit of mind, and on the other hand, European, Western, imperial colonialism that victimized the Arab people. So you have Jews surviving out of a long and terribly violent history of anti-Semitism, and you have Arabs, Palestinians, determined to survive the assault of colonialism as they've experienced it. Both of those ancient traditions of the West are part of this story. My own view is that the negotiations toward a two-state solution are still to be hoped for, still to be supported. And I believe that a reconciliation of this impasse is possible, and when it comes about, it will have tremendous importance for the world. I'll just add one other thing, though. That apocalyptic vision that took root in Jerusalem that I was talking about before, mm-hmm. the millennial end-of-the-world vision, really didn't have absolute resonance until 1945 with the coming of the atomic bomb, which is an apocalyptic weapon. That old idea that the way to salvation is through destruction now has the technical means to make it real. We can destroy the earth. Is that the method of salvation that God wills? I don't believe it for a minute. Nuclear weapons make this whole mess, to go back to the word I used at the beginning, absolutely infinitely dangerous. And it's no surprise that Jerusalem is the ground zero of that threat too, with the threat of proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, including Iran on one side and Pakistan on the other, and now the turmoil among Arab nations, about which we can be hopeful, but we have to understand what the stakes are. And Jerusalem's Israel's own nuclear weapons are a key part of this problem now, because the so-called temple weapons that Israel has are a justification for the possible cascade of proliferation that could follow in that region. It needs to be a nuclear-free zone. And I know that's actually a taboo subject in Israel, actually.
It is.
And Israel doesn't confirm having nuclear weapons, but it does. This is the last act in the old drama of apocalyptic Jerusalem. And we have to get this right, or the story is going to take a really terrible turn.
So we will hope that the new core will be the core of nonviolence and peace that Jerusalem is founded on for the rest of our centuries.
Indeed so.
James Carrolls, thank you so much for being in the studio today.
My privilege.
It's been an honor. The book Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World. Of course, James Carroll is the distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University, columnist for the Boston Globe, and his other book that everybody knows about, Constantine's Sword. This book, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, is a wonderful book for all of us who think about our worlds to wrestle with. And Jim Carroll, once again, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.